Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
My name is Alan, and we are from ReverseThieves.com. If you have anything you'd like us to talk about, any comments, questions, or criticism, you can email us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com, or you can come on our super cool Discord filled with super cool people with growing channels to ask us anything there, or maybe ask your fellow anime and manga fans about questions or comments or things you feel that they should know about.
And if you've never used a Discord before or are new to it, you can actually come onto our server and lurk. There's no if you're more of a lurker person, you don't have or not forced to speak. So feel free to come on there just to see more about other stuff that we're reading or watching. You know, like we have some sections that are not anime and manga related, so just like more general chatting and things like that. So feel free to come on there. If you've never used Discord before, you know, there's some really handy guides, and our server is a good one to use just because it's very small, so it's not very intimidating. Also, on the podcast, we have started a new segment, which is the manga of the month. So if you're a longtime reader or listener, you might remember that this segment has been on the blog, but we are trying it out in podcast form. So we have two episodes out so far, and we're gonna just see how that goes. Inevitably, we recorded those episodes and, like, I don't think we introduce ourselves or where we're from or anything, as if, you know, we haven't been podcasting for like over a decade. But that's fine. It's a work in progress. So go check those out.
Clearly, you were just remembering the time when we would have the pre-recorded segments and would just pop them on at the beginning.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good excuse.
That's my excuse.
And this month's episode of The Speakeasy, we are just doing kind of a mishmash of things we've been watching and reading. So before we get to all that,
we have the Type Moon Minute. As I mentioned, just before the last episode came out, the summer events were on the way. And this time we are back in Hawaii for Surf Fest. Summer Servant Festival 2023. So it's once again doujinshi and kamiket related. I think, in fact, the event started when summer kamiket started in Japan. It also did not help that a bunch of the monsters in there were starting fires, and it was when a bunch of wildfires broke out, and they had to like go on Twitter and be like, this has been planned out for months. This is not supposed to be like in any way related to real world events. We're sorry if anybody like thinks that, or like, you know, thinks that like we're making fun or anything. This is just pure coincidence. And, you know, our hearts go out to everybody, you know, affected by said wildfires. Other than that, we mostly got, the most popular chapter has been for the longest time was Babylonia, which is why that's the one that got like an anime adaptation. But the one that like super surpassed it was Avalon the Fae, which was written by Nasu himself, and it took place in like Fae dominated England, and it had like Morgana Le Fay and a bunch of like Fae servants. And so there's a general rule that they won't make a character a summer servant until 2 years after they're introduced, and since that chapter came out 2 years ago, it's like everyone was like, oh man, I hope they have one or two servants from that chapter. And it was like almost all servants from Avalon the Fae. And so a bunch of people were very happy, and there were a few people like, what is, you know, basically were upset that it all came from this one chapter. And it was like, the most popular chapter has a bunch of popular characters. Of course, they're going to throw those characters in swimsuits. I don't know why you think this was. You also got Oberon, who was drawn by the Honey and Clover Lady. So you got to see, him in two different styling swimsuits. So that went over very well, very popular. I think the most interesting thing was that they did like a lot of experimental mechanics, because like the 5-star is the highest rarity, but they didn't like, the next step down is the 4-stars, and they did a lot of like interesting experimental stuff with like the 4-stars. I guess in the idea that like, they're in swimsuits, so what do you call it? Even if you think they stink, you probably still roll for them because, you know, they're in swimsuits. And I was like, that's an interesting way to test out new mechanics. And then
putting a little sugar in the medicine.
Yes. The other two events that I just wanted to mention were that Witch on a Holy Night is coming out, I think, in Japan on Steam and eventually in the US on Steam. And I think they also made tentative plans to put Tsukihime out in Japan so far on Steam. So it generally seems like they want a console release, like get all the console sales out of the way, and then they release it on Steam.
What was the lag?
I think about a year and a half for both. So that seems to be their new strategy for like the least of it. So that's interesting that like you don't have a console, but most people have a computer. So eventually, it seems like all these games will eventually be coming. This interesting. And my last bit of news is that Fate Samurai Remnant comes out at the end of the month. So I will probably play a little of that and talk about it on the next Type Moon Minute. So I will see you then, Type Lunatics.
Okay, so to kick things off, I'm going to just start in like the most serious thing. And then I think things can only go up from there. Unless something Al like teased at the beginning of this, he's like, how much disturbing stuff can you take? So now I'm very curious about what Al's gonna talk about.
Whatever happens in Oku is gonna be worse. I just have to talk about one really dumb online phenomena, in my opinion. I'm sure other people will tell you it's serious, but whatever, I can't.
Well, Oku is definitely serious, and we talked about the first episode when we were reviewing the new season of anime, and that was an extra long, you know, hour and a half sort of movie style episode. And this is a anime on Netflix, so I was able to just watch the whole thing. That's why I'm able to review it now as opposed to like when the season officially ends. And the rest of the episodes are normal lengthed episodes, and it's 10 episodes. I feel like Netflix has been staying in a, like, not quite a season, you know, like 10 or, I feel like there's been a lot of them that have been about, like, 10, maybe, I think Edgerunners was also 10, so
I
it's like.
I think One Piece live action is still,
like. They must think that's, like, the sweet spot, you know, of episodes. I won't rehash the first episode of Oku, but that is sort of kind of a prelude to the rest of the series. So we, you know, the basic premise is that there is a disease in Japan that targets young men, and it is like a very rapid disease, and they get all these red marks on them, and then they die like fairly quickly. And so there's a huge, and this has gone on for years at the point of the first episode. And so it's like society has sort of rebuilt itself around there being 25% men and 75% women. So women are, you know, the business owners, they're the heads of families, they do a lot of the work, you know, they're really running society, and men are like commodities in a certain sense. There's pleasure districts for them, but there's also just like if you happen to have a man in the family, like that can be like big marriage material, but they're also like very coveted, and so they're like protected a lot of the time. So because they're worried that they're going to get this disease. And so at the end of the first episode, go ahead, Al.
I just have a question. I'm not sure how much it comes up in the whole series you've read. How much who does the child rearing?
It does come up in this section, or at least. Okay. So here's the thing is that, so at the end of the first episode, our new shogun, because the shogun is also a woman, you know, like who's running the country. But for the most part, the rest of the world doesn't know that, and that's hidden. And so at the end of the first episode, the new shogun, she goes to the archivist and is like starting to read the secret history of like how this all began. And so I thought that, so the second episode is like, we're going back, right? And so like, we're going back to like the beginning of how did the shogun become a woman? You know, like how did the whole sort of conceit of the Oku, right? Which is the sort of the shogun's harem of men, how did that develop, all of that stuff. So I thought that we were going to go back and we were going to get like a few episodes of like the secret history, you know, and then we were going to like return to the present and like find out, like, how she was going to use this information, you know, politically and, like,
so it would basically, like, be one of those Yang watches a history documentary episodes of Legend of the Galactic Heroes.
I mean, not quite that much, because it's like, it is her own history. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I feel like it's totally relevant. Not that the Yang episodes aren't relevant, but they're like more abstractly relevant than like this is like directly relevant. But I thought we were like going to go back and we were going to, you know, find out about the first lady shogun. And then it was like going to move back to like the quote unquote present, you know, like current time, present, I guess, current timeline or whatever.
Present day, present time.
But basically that never happens. And so like the entire rest of the season is like just linear from like this disease starting to ravage Japan. And then like everything from that point forward, like, so the secret history just becomes the linear narrative basically. And there's no like interspersing of the present timeline or anything like that. And like, I really wanted to return to the new shogun. And every episode, especially like the first, or episodes like 2 through 4, all of them are really horrible, horrible things are happening. Not that nothing horrible happens in the first, like, movie-length episode, but, like, ultimately that has, like, a like, positive trajectory, I guess. And, like, the secret history is just awful. Like, it's... So, we have the shogun, who is a very, very young woman. Like, I think she's maybe... She's a teenager, I'll say. I don't really remember exactly how old she is at the point where they're, like, starting the story. But, like, the original shogun dies, and they hide it. Basically, his sort of nurse becomes sort of this, like, shadow figure in the government. And she basically hides that he is dead and, like, kills everybody that was there to, like, witness it. And then, like, installs all these people. Like, basically creates the whole conceit of, like, the Oku, the shogun being a woman, but actually in like all these public facing, it's like somebody else pretending to be the shogun, because like they don't show them fully anyway. So like no one really knows that he's not, like, that he's dead. And her whole plan is, it's interesting because you think when I said that, right, that she is like maybe personally like scheming or something like mm-hmm. that. But her like her initial plan is that she just wants the daughter to produce an heir, a male heir, and then they will say that the old shogun died, and then like they have a new heir. So like that's her whole plan, and she's just obsessed with bloodlines, and that it had like, because she could just install anyone, right? Because it's like, you know, she's like holding all the cards essentially. But and she has like a council of people who like all are very deferential to her and everything, but she's just like obsessed with the bloodline. So she really thinks that that is important. And so enter our other main character, who is Arikoto, who is a Buddhist monk, and he has like he's like 18, he's young, but he's like taken the vows of celibacy and all this stuff, and like basically he just like gets ripped from the streets because I don't know, he's a super hot monk, and they're like, no, we just can't let you, you can't,
hotness is too strong.
Yeah, it's just too much. And I mean, he does have like nobility bloodlines or whatever. But yeah, essentially, this lady just like forces him to come to the castle and then never lets him leave. And then like forcibly makes him give up his vow of celibacy. Literally. And by murdering people in front of him until he has sex with someone. In front of all of them, because they have to like confirm that this is happening. So like that's the level, that's like episode 2. So like
fun
that's
times.
That's the level of disturbing. And I won't spoil the rest of the series. I know that was a real like endorsement for everybody to watch it. But like that's the level of machination, I guess, that's going on. And then like the emperor, she is like, I keep switching emperor and shogun. I'm sorry about that. I think she's the shogun.
So In that time period, she would be the shogun, because the shogun is the actual power. The emperor is like a prop, and the shogun is the actual legitimate power, because that's one of the big like conceits of the Meiji Rebellion, is that they're going to overthrow the shogun and put the emperor back on the throne proper.
Okay, so yes, so I think she's the shogun. So it goes through a pretty expansive period of time in the next, for the rest of the season. I think it goes through about like maybe 10 years. And, you know, we see sort of a growing relationship between the shogun and Arikoto, and how that really changes. Like, Arikoto sort of changes the entire dynamics of the Oku, and like how the men behave there, like kind of all the stuff that's in it is really interesting, because all the stuff you see in the first episode, like the fashion, you know, and like all of that stuff sort of comes from him, but not in a really ostentatious way. Like, he's just trying to make life more interesting being there, and so like he really changes the dynamics there. And he's basically, he is an actual Buddhist saint. Like, he is a saint. There is no better person in this series, and he is like very understanding of everything that's happening. Not understanding, but like accepting of certain things, and for very forgiving of certain things, and like, you know, comes to really like,
Kate,
I don't know.
You already have already stated, Justin, how in episode 2 he was dealt a pretty shit hand.
Yeah, and like things, yeah, and like the shogun herself is like in a really difficult position, but also she's really horrible. Like, she's pretty horrible, but she's also had horrible things happen to her. So there's just like a lot of horrible. There's a lot of horrible. And so I kept being like, okay, can we go back now? Can we go back to the current timeline? Like, can we just, I get it. It's real bad. It's really, really bad. And like, everything is bad. But I think kind of by the end of the season, like, if they were going to do more, potentially we could maybe be at the current timeline. Like, because they do tell like a pretty extensive story in the first season about the first shogun. It's just like, it's a lot to take. It's really good. It's really well done. But it's and, you know, it's pretty harrowing at points. And like,
you gotta carry that weight.
Yeah. And it's like, whoa, this is, I mean, it's sort of, it's not like surprise. It's not like shocking, because you're like, this is probably what I could imagine would happen in this situation a lot of times. But I will say, the thing you asked about, Al, about the child rearing aspect. So one story that we do follow a little bit in these episodes is of a farming family. I wasn't sure, like, I thought like, oh, is this gonna like cross with the shogun in some way, like that we don't expect, you know, like, is like something about, but I think really what's more important about it is it's sort of showing you the like peasant experience of like what's happening at the same time. And your question about like, oh, well, like, what about the child rearing and stuff like that? Like, one of the things that I found, again, just like sort of horrible about the whole thing was that even though men were sort of fragile at this point and like had to be protected and like, you know, they needed to, you know, they couldn't contribute in the same way that they did in society. They like, many of the men don't then take up any of the housework. It's just like, oh, well, now they do nothing.
Yeah, I had a theory that that was going to be the case. I was like, I don't think they're going to switch all the gender roles. I feel like in many ways, it just feels like the males just like lose all place in society other than sperm donation.
And it's sort of, but it's also just like, it makes you see it in a way that's like, it's so, I don't know what the word I guess I'm looking for here is, but it's like, they're not willing to do a different part of it. Basically, It's like, oh, well, like, women, you should, that's your job. You should just like, it's like the dynamic is really like, ugh, I guess. Also then like the pleasure district factors into this some, and then like how men are then commodified in certain ways. And I don't know, it's just, it's not like the gender roles completely changed. It's like women just have to take on more, almost like there's just like even more of a burden on them in certain ways. So like it's just like an interesting dynamic, at least in the past one. I think again, in the current timeline of the story, it's like things have shifted certainly as time has gone on. But like, yeah, seeing it from the past is like, and then like how much resistance obviously there is there, where it's like, because this is a new phenomenon as opposed to like embedded already in the current timeline, whereas like, you know, how much the older generation like can't accept like certain things while this is happening, even though it's like we're starving or like we're losing all of our crops or like you have to let me work. I know I'm a woman, but like if you don't let me, like we will just like lose everything. And like, is it really more important for like me to not do that? Or is it more important for like us to survive? And so like, all of those things are very interesting. Oh boy, but it is a lot. It's definitely super, super serious, and lots and lots of bad things happen to lots of bad and good people. Lots of people do some really, make some really bad decisions. Arikoto, saint, Buddha himself, super hot. Once they make him grow his hair back out because he had to like shave it when he was a monk. You know, I feel like there's this scene where that, like, where you get to see that for the first time. And it's almost as if the series wants me to be like, oh, well, now I understand. Like, it's like, no.
Oh, she's a good person now.
All worth it. Like, it was all worth it. I'm just kidding. I don't really think that's what the author wanted, but I feel like just the way it's done.
Like, I was about to say, also, I feel like Arikoto might be like, I have some minor objections. Just throwing out some criticisms.
Oh, cool. I would definitely be interested to watch more if they do end up making any more. I know the manga is, I think it's over. It's pretty long. But I think it's maybe finished. I'm not sure. But yeah, if they made more, I would watch it, and with all the warnings I gave, I definitely still think it was like, it was really very good.
Oh, I have an answer for you, Kate. I went to the to basically the Brain of Manga Baka updates. It is complete in Japan.
Okay. How many volumes?
19.
Okay.
So that possibly is one of the reasons that I got it on. It's like sometimes the new thing of, well, I guess they're ending up, got time to actually put it out on me.
But since it's a Netflix anime, yeah. I really don't know, you know, how they're going to measure, you know, all of the stuff that we say all the time about Netflix. So
yeah, Netflix is like infamous for canceling things.
And this is really I do feel like this is such an unusual show in the sense that it's just like, it's basically just like a court drama. You know, there is no action, there is no like superpowers or magic or anything. It's just like high drama basically. So I definitely want to support more of that and encourage everyone else to as well, but it's unusual, so I just have no idea how it's being received,
which in many ways is by design for streaming services. So we joke that there was one show that we missed from the last season after like a little bit of discussion, and so I was like, you know, we did joke that we missed, you know, the Great Cleric, or as I sometimes like to call it because of the, you know, the Good Doctor, the Good Cleric. I was like,
what I just think of it as.
Let me go and actually see what this series is about, because it seemed to like actually get like a somewhat small amount of positive buzz, and it was a show that like, you know, what didn't seem like it had the worst premise. It wasn't like, and then the 1,000-year-old Lolly gets married to the businessman. So I was like, all right, or like some kind of redo of Healer, which I won't even state the premise because no. So the premise is that apparently Truckoon has, you know, or Truck-sama has some, you know, wants to take a vacation. So instead in this story, a salesman who's a, you know, a salary man, he's, you know, just finally made a big deal that like can, you know, help out his company, and they're gonna have a big party for him. And you see like this criminal run out of a police box where he just tried to steal a police officer's gun who he shot, and the police officer catches up to him, struggles, and our main character is shot and killed. And like, you know, the isekai force awakes him in this new realm, and all he knows, like, it doesn't give him a lot of information about the world. It just tells him that he is a healer. He's basically like a, you know, in D&D terms, he's a cleric class character. Starting out, he, like, gets to pick a few, like, very simple skills. And then he basically just is plunked into the world and has to figure. And so, he, like, gets to, like, the first town he can find and, like, has a little trouble getting in and, like quickly realizes he doesn't really know that much about the world, and quickly discovers that in this world, like, there's essentially like a very powerful, just a cleric mafia that charges like out the nose for any healing, and basically like the common people resent but rely on the healers of the land. And so our main character, like being kind of like a fish out of water, like kind of upends it and ends up like training at, like wanting to be an adventurer and a healer. So he ends up training at the Adventurers Guild, and in return for them training him, he basically heals them. And at first they're like super, they're just used to, the bad clerics of the land. Like the country they live in is like one of the few that outlawed slavery. But the clerics go, oh, you owe us more money than you can pay? Well, we don't have slavery anymore, but there's this guy from another country and he's willing to buy your debt, and then you become a slave there. But we don't, I didn't sell you into slavery. I just sold your debt to someone from another country. And so, if you just happen to end up a slave there, womp womp.
Why? Why does there need to be
slavery in all these series?
Why is there need to be so much of it?
Well, at least in this series, Kate, they are the bad guys. It is not the main, like, the main character finds this disgusting and is working his hardest to, like, heal people so they don't have to buy into this horrible system. So, in isekai terms, this is a step up from a bunch of other series where I guess I have to participate in slavery. What choice do I have? You have lots of choices, main character. You have lots of choices.
Yes.
This is the state of isekai where I'm like, the main character who finds slavery revolting and wants to make sure that people aren't put into slavery is a major benefit.
Sad, but true. Okay, well, I guess I will. Yes, I'll take that as a plus.
And so, like, the series is, like, so at this point, he's, like the main, like, guild leader of the, like, basically the main church leader of the town he starts in on. Basically, like, forces the higher-ups to send him to the capital for a quote-unquote promotion because he just, like, can't stand this guy going around and healing people and taking away, his valuable income and, and so he's like working in the capital now, like going through this dungeon to like trying to prove himself so he can like get back home to his the town that he started in. And I don't know. It's interesting. And like part of me wonders, is this very insightful like commentary on today, or is it accidental? Like, I can't tell, because like there is something interesting, like an immediate, like super, like, if it's commentary, it's like kind of cleverly sly, because like it could be like a very like, but I'm like, is this, it seemed like if this was America, I'd say this was like very interesting insight. But I'm like, is like, I think like healthcare is like at least somewhat better in Japan, because like if this was an American series, like its comment on like, because like all the adventurers are like working class and poor, and like it's a job a lot of people take when they can't get into other jobs. And then so like they're like forced to get into this dangerous low paying position. And like, and then like the capitalist like healthcare system takes care, like advantage of them. And it's like quickly makes them decide, well, do you want slavery and or like forever to be indebted to the, the church, aka the healthcare system? And then just like, or like, oh, I guess now you now owe so much money that you have to, do more adventuring, which possibly gets you more hurt, which makes you go back to the church to get more healing, which makes you do more adventuring. Oh, the other classes, they can all pay for stuff more, and it's not a problem for them, so they don't really care. But, like, they rely on the adventurers, but, like, they just turn a blind eye to them. And apparently, like, a lot of beast people who are generally seen as lower class have to get into adventuring because it's the only way they can get jobs, but they're hated and don't want them in the rest of society. I'm like, there's some really, like, if this is intentional, it's very clever because it never, like, comes out and says that it's commentary, but it's, like, well done. And if it's accidental, which part of me wonders if it is, it's, like, accidentally very insightful.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard. It's always hard to say, like, but I do think there is certainly plenty of there's plenty of treating people who have low wage jobs badly across the world and using them, you know, as like disposable people. I don't think no country has a lock on that sort of treatment of people. It is the healthcare part of it is very interesting, but I also don't know. I mean, it's, like, I don't know how, say, workers who are foreigners are treated in the healthcare system. Like,
way beyond me. That's why part of the reason I can't tell how much it's commentary, because I'm just not that well versed in, like, the nuances of Japanese society to know how much, and I know nothing about the original author to know, like, how much of this is commentary about Japan, how much is this his commentary about the present world in general. Like, you know, I know nothing about their, like, outside politics, or, like, you know, that might be like an indication of which, you know, how much of this is intentional, accidental,
or is it even like commentary on other light novels or like fantasy world. I don't know, you know, like, because you kind of, how you were saying that, like, so many fantasy novels kind of lean into slavery for inexplicably.
Or, like, fetishy, distinctly for fetish reasons.
So and is, like, it, like, you know, trying to combat that, you know? And I don't know. That's interesting.
I mean, there's a lot of, like, goofball comedy. Like, he's almost drinking this, like, substance X, which actually becomes, like an important plot point. And, you know, goofy antics about, you know, his super tough trainer. And, like, he's, like so pushes himself to train and heal people. He becomes, like, the masochist zombie. So, like, it's not all, like, you know, for serious, you know. And they're, like, some attractive girls that eventually, you know, vaguely become interested in. It has a bunch of normal isekai, you know, half comedy, half adventure story stuff. So, like, that made me think that it's all, like, this, you know, deep commentary about present society. And, like, cause I have to put that in. Otherwise, you think this is, like, you know, like some deep, you know, the socialist creed that is, you know, the great healer. Come, comrades, let us, what do you call it, take down bourgeoisie capitalism and all that, it, what do you call it, exploits the common man. That might be in there as well, but there's also, is it this bunny girl hot?
Okay, now we're talking about the isekai that we all know.
I mean, that's just the common stuff. Also, like, his superpower is essentially, other than, like, his, like, healing abilities, is just that he used to be, like, a salaryman, so he knows, like, how to engage in, like, politics and, like how to, like,
negotiate or
negotiate and, like, how to, like, avoid this kind of, like, drama and, like,
I was gonna ask, yeah, how, like, his it does anything from his past. So he's not reborn, he's just himself.
So he was just, like, generic, you know, black-haired salaryman. I don't even think we fully see his face. But, I mean, now he's, like, good-looking, silver-haired guy.
Okay. But you know what I'm saying, right? Because some of them are, like,
he wasn't, like,
reborn as a baby or something.
He was, like, he, like, starts as a young teenager. He basically, because it's, like, at this point in the season, that's, like, 10 episodes in, he's already, like, a young adult, but he starts out, like, 14, like, when he would start his apprenticeship. And he's just, boom. So he doesn't, like, have a childhood or family. He's, like, just
in fact, that's one,
like,
day.
One of the first, he has to, like, lie about being from a super small town that he just makes up and like nobody's ever heard of it. He's like, can I just put down hometown? So like, yeah, he like just like springs fully formed from the head of Zeus.
Okay.
So he has all his memories of being from his past life. And he has like only his memory one is waking up. And that's so a bunch of things have to be explained to him and the like and the audience and people like essentially like, how the fuck do you not know, like not in the thing, like how the fuck do you not know this? It's like a few, like a bunch of the first early episodes, like this is not something, I know you come from a backwoods hood, you know, hick town, but this is still something you should know as just a person who has lived 14 years. How do you not know some of these things?
So is this a series you think you'll continue watching?
Yeah, I mean, there's like one dumb mystery of like keeps going into this dungeon and like at first he thinks it's a simulation because he hasn't gotten any like, because he's mostly just done all cleric work and this is like his first adventuring work and he hasn't gotten any experience points. So he hasn't gone up in any points of adventurer. So he's like, I'm curious. There's very clearly a plot reason why. I'm very curious to find that. Kate, you're going to be finding this really weird. I'm very curious of the mechanics of how this system works. And thereby, they've hooked me on the thing that hooks Al on things, which is, how does this mechanical, magical system work? Kate, like, immediately, you didn't see it, but Kate immediately went, oh, I fully understand everything about now. How Al must keep watching this because that is the most Al thing to do.
Yes, but also, would you watch it for other reasons or no?
I mean, I'm also just really curious. I'm like, keep trying to figure out, like, how intentional is this commentary? Or is it all accidental? I mean, it's not poorly written. I don't think it's the best written show ever. Like, I feel like Log Horizon feels like a little smarter. But it's not poorly written. And like, parts of it intrigue me enough just to like try to figure out, once again, what's the system of this world? And also like, what? And once again, like, how much of this is intentional? I like very, or if anybody like who reads Japanese or maybe is a little more into that, I'm very curious if they have any insight into this author and what's going on.
All right. So as promised, I am finally going to talk about the Final Stroke Part 2 because it was finally released on Crunchyroll after months of waiting. And I initially wanted to just watch both movies at once to talk about them, but that didn't happen. So I won't rehash the first part of the movie. So I'll just kind of talk about a little bit about the ending of Free, the real ending of it. And I think the movie ends really well. It kind of comes full circle to season one in certain ways, and I really appreciated that. And like, it had like some good emotional weight there. I think, unfortunately though, I think the bulk of the movie is a little flat. Like the end of the first, like the first movie was really good, I thought, and like had some real drama and ends in a really dramatic place for Haru. And the second movie is, you know, following up directly on that, but it's a lot of other characters talking about Haru in this movie too. Just like Haru's not in every scene. And in fact, I don't think he's in enough scenes in the movie. There's just like tons of people having conversations about how do you think Haru is doing in the second movie. And
I'm not sure you've ever seen the episode, but you've seen it quoted a million times. It just reminds me of that line about Poochie from The Simpsons where like they're trying to retool him to be more popular. And it's like anytime when you call it, Poochie is in a scene, all the characters should be asking, what do you think Poochie's doing?
And that sort of is how it's happening in this movie. I just, like the second movie is really about, like, Haru's mental state and, like, him coming to terms with a few things. And then, like, how does he work through that and, like, get to the other side of it? And I just felt like there was a lot of people talking about that instead of us just experiencing Haru going through it. And I just wanted more of that. And, you know, it was just a little too much like telling and not showing, I think. Because when they were showing stuff, it was really good. But the second movie, like, I really can't totally blame them. But I think that they had kind of resisted doing this before this movie and did a good job of, like, weaving it together between, like, fan service and, like, telling a really great story. And I feel like maybe they lost that a little bit in this second movie. Not that there was, like, tons of, like, what, like, kind of the, there's traditional fan service in here. And then there's just, like, the second movie, the conversations characters are having, some of these characters have never talked to each other. Like, I don't think they've ever shared a scene, like, prior to this movie. And it felt like they were like, well, we just want to make sure that, like, any ship that exists, we'll just, like, make sure that these characters who've never spoken just have a random scene together. And then why would they be having a scene together? Oh, I know. They'll be talking about Haru. Like, that's, like, literally how so many of these scenes happen and feel. And so I just felt like a little bit of fan service just to get those scenes in. And then, so even though I did think the structure was not great, like I said, I think it ultimately ends really, really well in, like, a very satisfying place. The series actually resists showing us the characters in the future, which, like, your mileage may vary about how you feel about that. Like, it ends and they're, like, at their current state, and, like, we don't see them, like, you know, 10 years later or, like, anything. We don't get any of that. And then then the other part of the fan service, which is, like, oh, also this movie has, like, three endings, like it's Lord of the Rings or something. Like, you just keep thinking it's over and then it's not. And then, this must be the end. No, never mind. Okay, wait, here it is. One confusing thing at the end in terms of fan service is there's a character that has a couple of scenes right at the end, and I didn't know who they were, and they were in a character I had never seen before, and I was like, oh, this, like, person must be, like, I don't know, who are they? And it never explains who they are. And then, like, so I had to look it up, and they never talk or anything, but they just have these, like, really significant, like, moments where they're, you know, right at the end, and it's, like, a random character from one of the novels that was, like, a childhood friend of some, whatever. Anyway, so that was, it was confusing from a narrative standpoint, because I just kept being like, I don't know.
Did I
okay.
forget this person or?
Yeah, and they don't actually do anything, but it was just kind of felt awkward. And then, okay, so once the movie actually ends, then there's just, like, a montage for so long, longer than even, you know how, like, you have the movie song at the end or whatever, and then they, like, show, like, whatever, images? This is, like, so long that the music is, like, over, it's, like, taking forever, and it's just, like, images of all the, like, official free art that was, like, all, like, you know, like, them in tuxes, them as a boy band, them, like, I don't know, going on safari, whatever, like, every official piece of art I think that was ever made is, like, montaged at the end, just to make sure that you, like, got to see absolutely everything that has ever been made for free. That part I didn't mind, because that was really funny and fun. So, yeah, it was just, like, it was a lovely journey. I really, really appreciated where, like, a lot of the characters end up in the end of this story. And like I said, I just, it does ultimately feel really good at the end. I do just feel like this movie was kind of weak, a little weaker structurally than I would have liked. But I can kind of understand, you know, like, them trying to really, like, please the fans in certain ways. But I think they could have done both. They've done both throughout the entire run of Free. So I think they could have done it here, but it was still good.
Okay, I have a few questions and comments. One, in the multiple ending, did they keep Toru coming back home and finding Saruman had taken over the hometown and the pool, you know, the
Look,
scouring
I,
of
no
the Shire?
No spoilers. No spoilers.
Oh, you can't tell if the scouring of the Shire ending part was added?
I like I said, I'm not gonna have spoilers. Maybe the person that I told you about who showed up
was Saruman.
Could have been.
The other comment I wanted to make, because we discussed this a little in real life, and I just wanted to mention again, also the most Al thing to mention, is there is when Hayate was ending, this chapter where basically Nagi comes to Hayate and is like, hey, you know, Squid Girl, the manga's ending. And then Hayate's like, oh, wow. And then they just have a discussion about how hard it is to end a manga series and like all the pitfalls and things that like, oh, you've got to wrap up all these things. And sometimes the fans remember things that the mangaka doesn't, or the fans prioritize things that the mangaka doesn't think are as important as other things. Everybody has their own headcanon of how it's going to end. And like the mangaka has to decide of like, you know, the difference between how he wants to end it and the fans want to end it. And it's very clear after a certain point that it is not Nagi and Hayate talking about Squid Girl. It's basically Hata going through ending Hayate soon and like all the, you know, internal thoughts that he has. But like, it always reminds me of like this balancing act of like, how much do you want to tell a good story and the story you want to tell, and how much do you want to like satisfy the fans and make them happy? And I feel like I can almost see like the people working on Free, like having that, like, we want this story to end well, which I think you said it, you know, ultimately at the core, it ends well. But like this thing of like, well, you know, this is how we go out and we want fans to remember us well. And like, we want to give the people what they want. And like, you know, I think in your opinion, they did both, but maybe they aired a little too hard on like, what do you call it? Maybe giving people what they wanted a little too much.
Yeah, I think maybe just it from my point of view, I think that is how I feel. But like, I can kind of it wasn't so much that it was a bad movie. It was just like, I think it could have been better. And I also am judging that by I did not cry in this movie, and I really thought that I would. And so I feel like it wasn't quite there. And since this is the last time I'll talk about Free probably, so I just want to end on Rin and Sosuke are the best boys. And that's it.
I feel like you got the most important thing for Kate's out of the way. So we've had one thing that had a lot of anticipation for Kate. So let's talk about something that had a lot of, I guess, anticipation, maybe a little like
trepidation.
I'm going to talk about, I threw myself on the grenade to save Kate. I watched all of the first season of live action One Piece.
And so, you're still here to tell the tale.
Look, Kate, I watched Yoko no Sora. I survived that first episode. I think it made me stronger.
I thought you were gonna say Cowboy Bebop.
Oh yeah, no. What do you mean? What?
So I feel like
live action Cowboy Bebop has to come up, so I have to acknowledge that I watched all.
Yeah.
So apparently this has been getting amazingly good reviews. Like it's the high on Rotten Tomatoes, both from critics and fans. I just like either today or like in the last 3 days, they did announce that they are going forward with a season 2. I like just watched a video about like how like it's a very good adaptation. I think it's serviceable. I think that possibly live action Cowboy Bebop has so set the, I'm not sure how much it's me, like how much it's actually good of me agreeing, and how much it's live action Cowboy Bebop has set the bar so subterranean that anything vaguely competent could jump over it. I think the core thing to mention, and I guess this is the most important thing, is if nothing else, if you have no other praise for the series and like the greatest failures of live action Cowboy Bebop, at least live action One Piece understands the themes of One Piece and understands the characters of One Piece. Therefore, it is infinitely a better adaptation than live action Cowboy Bebop, just by those two factors alone. And those are pretty important factors, in my opinion, of an adaptation, that you at least understand how to express the main themes of the original work and understand and know how to express the main cast of the original. There are some differences, but when there are differences, it feels like they were deliberate. Like they made these choices conscious. So it doesn't feel like these changes were made because they were trying to stick to the original and just didn't know how to do it or did it wrong. It feels to me that most of the changes there are very purposeful. So if you don't know, this is covering the first major arc of One Piece, the East Blue arc. So it covers, you know, the introduction of Luffy and, you know, the world of One Piece, you know, that there's, you know, Gold Roger was caught and executed by the world government before he died. He said that all my treasures are on the One Piece and starts this age of piracy. And Luffy is a person there. We meet and recruit Zoro, Nami, Sanji, and Usopp. And it ends with them at the end of Arlong Park. Theoretically, their next stop would be Roku. And that would start, basically like the up. I forget what the upstream arc and then Baroque works. It's only 8 episodes. So it's very much like...
Oh, I thought you said it was 10.
I'm sorry. You're right. It's 10 episodes. You are correct, Kate. It is 10 episodes, so it's very, like, I wouldn't say cliff notes, but it's very much an accelerated pace. Like,
how long are the episodes?
1 hour. So it's all, has to be all killer, no filler. Like, it tells everybody's story pretty quickly. I will say they at least, once again, know all the emotional bits to hit. At this point, would you like to hear more what I liked or what I didn't? Which one do you think I should start?
Let's start with the bad and end with the good.
Okay.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I guess if you're going to recommend the show, I would say start with the bad, end with the good. If you don't recommend the show, you're neutral.
Yeah.
Then okay, bad and then end with good.
Okay. So, okay. The worst part is, so I feel like, like you said, there's no, like, set, like, guidelines by Netflix, but, like, I do feel like certain things are taken from, like, I don't know, maybe it's, like, encouraged by Netflix, or just people think it's encouraged beyond Netflix, but they make a very big, like, the Straw Hat Pirates is very much the usually forefront A plot, but in every episode, there's a B plot, kind of like with the Vicious thing of in Cowboy Bebop live action, where every episode is about Kobe, Garp, and Helmeppo, and the Marines. It's never, like, a huge part, and sometimes, like, they interact more. It's kind of like half an adaptation of the cover stories with Garp, Helmeppo, and Kobe. But, like, they, like, play a part in, like, Syrup Island, where, like, you meet Usopp. They appear there, and they're, like, they show up at the end with, they're, like, a lot responsible for, like, parts of, like, the way they recruit Sanji. You might not ever remember that character, but he's this blonde chef guy, Kate. You probably never read that part of One Piece where they introduce this character.
Vague, jackass-looking fellow.
Yes. They're, like, more involved than you would think in that part. It's never horrible, like, Vicious, but it's just it was an odd decision. Especially, like, how much they had to, like, condense down the other parts. Like, they usually hit the important highlights, but, like, if you're already condensing down the story, why are you spending a small part of every episode with this Kobe's and, like, the Marine stuff?
I have to wonder, not if it's simply a Netflix suggestion, but sort of a Western screenwriting for TV, like, you know, like,
yeah, convention.
Convention that, like, you need to have some sort of B plot, you know, for, like, series, for something that's, like, an hour long versus, like, I don't know anything about screenwriting, but, like, I just wonder if it has to do with, like, something about the way people are taught to, like, structure these things that and then it comes up as, because this isn't, you know, like, this isn't a Japanese made live action of One Piece, it's, you know, like, an American version of it, so, like, I don't know. That's just popped into my head as a possibility.
So it was weird. And it wasn't the worst, but, like,
you didn't
care. Yeah, I didn't care. And they were already cutting stuff down. So it seemed weird to add in this new, like, Kobe and Helmeppo are everywhere. And Garp are everywhere. But, apparently, I was talking to my brother, James. And he said he even heard that Oda was like, they shouldn't even introduce Garp till season 2. It was, like, one of the few, like notes that he had that they didn't, which was interesting. If what James has said is correct, that makes it even odder. Because they did a bunch of rewrites and stuff just for Oda's specification. But it seemed like that was the one they wouldn't budge on. And they really wanted that, you know, Gar, Kobe, Helmeppo, B plus. Also, although people loved it, there's nudity tag. And it's because they just have a scene of Helmeppo. Like, when Axe and Morgan captures Zoro and he's, like, playing with, Zoro's swords, but he's like naked, and you just see him doing like naked, like, you know, sword moves. And it's like, this is the only nudity. Why has the new tag? And they're like, man, we really need to see naked Helmeppo.
Look, Al, you don't know about all the Helmeppo Kobe shippers. I don't know.
I was also, Helmeppo definitely has like Vicious from live action Cowboy Bebop vibes, but in One Piece's defense, being the character that he is, that's justified. They didn't take a like cool badass villain character and make him a like
pathetic,
you know, pathetic, like, what do you call it, legacy child who never lives up to his, you know, that is who Helmeppo is. So like, that makes sense.
Yes, Helmeppo is a joke.
So like, so those vibes are not like, when you see Vicious like that, you're like, what did you do to this character? When you see Helmeppo like that, you're like, well, that you got that character. I can't complain about that. That's what that character is supposed to be. Two, they make Garp and like Luffy like weirdly antagonistical, which was never the, I like, they do it so they could have a character arc and like get him close, much closer to the original Garp at the end of the season. But like for a while, he's just like trying to catch that Luffy and like bring him in and like convince him not to be a pirate anymore. And it's just like a weird take on, and Garp is just a much angrier character. It's like kind of weird. And the absolute, well, there's two worst things. One, the actual worst thing is, and I've seen people praise this, but they make this Jared Leto Joker version of Buggy, and I am not a fan of it. Apparently, people really like it and also think that this version of Buggy is really hot. And I think it's also just this general, like, I've never been afraid of clowns. And I feel like for the longest time, that was like the thing about clowns, that people like, I'm super afraid of clowns. Like, I never understand why. Like, I've seen comedians do jokes about it. I've seen shows do. Like, I never understand why people think clowns, you know, should entertain at kids' parties. I think they're the scariest thing. But for some reason, like, in the last few years, like, people have decided that clowns are super hot. I mean,
what?
There is a term that I will not go into, but you can probably guess, just called clussy. And, like, I've seen people who, like, wear clown makeup in their YouTube videos because they think it's hot. And, like, people think clowns are hot, Kate. I do not understand it.
I'm shutting down the internet.
This is the disturbing thing I had to discuss, Kate. This is where it is.
I did not know this at all, and I don't want to know about it.
I will not inform you anything about Clussy. I think the fact that you know that term exists is all that, and
why? Why? Why, internet? Why?
So, yeah, no, but people think that this Buggy is super hot and like super approve of it. I do.
Is like, is Buggy's personality, so wait, if he is super hot, even though we're not saying we think he's hot, but then like, if you make Buggy super hot, is he just like a himbo who fails upwards? Is that like a clown himbo who fails upwards then?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because his personality is unchanged, correct?
Well, the thing is, like, there's a lot more death in this one. Like, remember Merry, the guy who, like is, like, he's, like, the sheep-looking guy. He's, like, the reason that the Going Merry has the sheep head, because he, like, designed the ship. And he's, like, one of, like, the people who work. He dies. Like, Kuro straight out kills him. Zoro is constantly killing people.
I mean, we know that, though. He does that in the OG.
But even when Luffy is around.
Because he's always, like, sneaking off and, like, taking care of... He's like, I gotta take care of something. And then, like... Oh, interesting. So Luffy's not trying to kill people?
Luffy is, like, one of the few people who doesn't kill people.
Oh, he's the Batman of this, yes. Of this realm. Okay.
He's still only... He wants to just break people... Like, break the bad guy's dreams, and he doesn't kill. That is still true. Luffy never kills anybody. He only knocks people out or like breaks their dreams if they're evil dreams. But the Marines, everybody's constantly killing people. There is a lot more death. Like Buggy kills a bunch of people. Like Arlong pirates kill a bunch of people.
Like on screen, you mean? Because I think there's like a lot of implied death.
Yeah, but there's a lot of on screen death.
You know, I feel like One Piece I don't feel like they're like, yeah, everybody is just, you know, captured or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they just don't show. I don't feel yeah. like you often see a lot of it. Interesting.
I'm not, that isn't a criticism either way. That's just, I guess I have a few neutral points now that I think about it.
And so that's one of them.
Two, man, a neutral point, possibly a selling point for some people. The main guys, it's like, is it a day ending? Well, why? One of them should take off their shirt.
I thought you said there was no nudity, Al.
What? I was just about to say, but what do you call it? They really, really like to, there's like no Nami fan service, but there is a lot of Sanji and Zoro fan service and just male mass fan service in general.
Okay. Interesting. An interesting opposition to the actual manga.
It's funny. They totally... probably the change my roommate would like the most. They totally cut out. Don Krieg exists for like 2 minutes. Like basically any part where Don Krieg is, they put in Arlong to have like Arlong Park come into play earlier. Like basically Mihawk, they introduce Mihawk by just him murdering all of the Don Krieg pirates. And he basically just like effortlessly, you just see Don Krieg for a second, and he's like, oh, here's the leader of the Don Krieg pirates after I've blown up all the ships. And he just like effortlessly kills Don Krieg, and he's just out of the story then. You do see Jin as like what the only survivor, and there's, you know, the part where like he comes and he's starving, and he has no money, and Sanji feeds him. And like Luffy is like, this guy's a good guy, he's gonna join my crew. You might not remember that part, but it happened.
I mean, I think that makes sense though, that they're gonna try to, because there's a lot of little side plots that are like relevant, but like I can see how you would just fold them into other things in the
that was neutral. That I feel like there was nothing bad about that. It's just interesting. Also, just like a lot of people's, like, I know my roommate hates that whole Don Krieg arc. He's like one of the most belabored parts. So he was like, yes, good decision. They do a lot of like early foreshadowing or like early setup for later stuff. Like when we meet Zoro, he's approached by Mr. Number 7, who like basically like tries to recruit Zoro into Baroque Works. And then Zoro basically like flips him off and says, I don't want to join your weird shadowy organization, and they have a fight, and then Zoro kills him, which is technically, as I found out, something that happens in the original manga. It's just, you never see it. Like, Zoro just is like, oh yeah, I've heard of that Baroque Works organization. They were trying to recruit me once. And so, like, they only have, like, a little, apparently they only ever had a little thumbnail picture of Mr. Number 7 that was just, like, in, you know, the SBS chapters. Like, they're like, someone basically asked, like, oh, what did Mr. Number 7 look like, who, you know, Zoro said that he killed in this backstory, and then he quickly sketched it. And so apparently the guy who they sent looks exactly like the sketch. So that's an interesting little... Also, like, when Zoro is, like, taken out by Mihawk and he's, like, recovering, Nami reads him a storybook that has the story of Nolan the Liar. So they already introduced, and they have a bunch of Nami
I get a little Nami Zoro shipping. Excellent. Good job, series.
But this is interesting. Oda said that one of the demands he had for the series was that they would not throw in unnecessary romance.
Oh yeah, that was actually one of my biggest questions. Like, one, my ships I don't think are real or like relevant.
That said, I feel like there is this weird, like, Nami, like, Zoro, like, I wonder how much that was, like, it feels like maybe that was one of the things they took out, but, like, they do seem to have, like, a heavy flirty vibe. I wonder if, like, in the original version that was more there and that was one of the things they took out.
Look, you're all fools. It's been there all along.
So, like, I don't know. I was wondering if they were going to, like, are they going to, like, do some Nami Zoro shipping here? And then I mean,
if Oda is as involved as they say he is, yeah. I just don't imagine that happening. And I think that's totally fine. But I was very curious about it.
But, like,
but if they're going to tease anyone, thank you. Thank you, Netflix One Piece.
I just, part of me now just. just if part of me wonders if that was in the original thing and that's why I'm picking up on it. And it just got like edited down. The good things I'd say is the casting is pretty good. They got Sonny Chiba's son to play Zorro. And so like he's very skilled. Like his fight scenes are really well done. And he's hot. And the internet has noticed that. The only thing that's weird, I don't object to it, but they definitely play him much more Wolverine-y. Then, like, he's a little more, like, cold than, like, you know, he's a little goofier in the original manga. He's a little more, like, edgy loner in, like, live action One Piece.
I mean, yeah, I like, is the comedy there? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's there. It's okay. Like, I feel like Usopp's generally, like, a lovable liar, and, like, they do a lot of the. Luffy is definitely a goofball who, like, you know, not very smart, but sometimes very insightful. But, you know, most of the time, not very smart, but a good guy.
Luffy is the best.
You know, Nami is very Fujiko in this, you know, snarky Fujiko, but that's her actual character in this arc. So, you know, like, apparently, like, the guy who plays Sanji, like, learned to kickbox and, like, actually went and, like, he seems very method that he, like, basically would cook meals every day. At least one meal a day for the rest of the cast every day that they were on set and like try not to use his hands and use his feet as much as possible while playing Sanji. I mean, they like made him a lot, you know, they didn't go full weird Usopp character design, but like the guy who plays Usopp definitely like captures like kind of the mixture of cowardness, but like hidden bravery and like, you know, boastful liar, but still being charming with Usopp, which I think is pretty good. The guy plays Luffy kind of gets the character of, you know, being dumb, but like earnest. And so good casting. My only thing is like, I feel like they make Zoro a little more conventionally Western edgelord, but apparently people really like that. So like, doesn't seem a bad, like, just like, it only makes it hotter. Once again, they do a lot of, like, a lot of the sets are practical, like, all the ships are like fully made and like they're not like CG ships. They actually made the ships. Although I will say that like the Going Merry's face makes me think goat sacrifice more than lovable goat mascot. But like obviously like, you know, CG Buggy and the Gum Gum powers are mostly going to be CG. As somebody mentioned, the snails are actually all Muppets. They're all little puppets.
That's cool.
And they have like little, like they invent a new technology, which is like little earpiece transponders, little transponder snails that you put in your ear. So you can have, cause like Mihawk is fighting people while talking to Garp. Well, he's basically killing all the Don Creek pirates and he's talking to him over a little like headset. Transponder snail.
I wonder how they'll do if they get to Chopper. I'd be curious how they would, you know, like Chopper's regular everyday form. Like how would they approach? How would they approach that?
The guy from Mother's Basement, whose video I just watched today, I mentioned, said he's like really hoping that they do a Muppet because he feels like it's just like he's like it's just inside the uncanny valley enough that like it would play well. Because if you do like CG Chopper, I feel like it won't. I was like, that's a good point. I like that point. Good point, Mother's Basement guy. That Muppet Chopper is probably like the best way to go with that. Plus also, like, I feel like it's easier to act off a puppet. Once again, they do seem to hit, like, they know what the core parts of all the storylines are. So they hit those pretty well. I mean, some of it looks goofy, but it's One Piece. They're doing the best that they can.
I mean, sometimes One Piece looks goofy. Yeah. So it's not.
I mean, and they lean into it. Like Garp has the hat, the dog hat, you know, the marine dog hat. The Nezumi guy from Arlong Park, you know, has the mouse ears and the little mouse cap to his. You know, so they definitely like embrace the like charm and weirdness of One Piece. So it's not like they're like, oh, this is bad. We've got to, you know, the people wouldn't accept this. We've got to make it, you know, more serious or real or something like that. They definitely like embrace the style of One Piece, which is good.
Should I watch it now?
I think you could watch it. I think if you didn't watch it, I don't think you've lost anything. You probably, I curious to see how much you'd... Actually, the only reason I really want you to watch it now is to see what your take on the Nami Zoro shipping would be.
Well, you know, I feel like when the cast was smaller, there was a lot more antagonism between them. Like, there was a lot, I feel like, and especially when she's, like, screwing them over. So, like, I feel like, because Zoro's, like, very suspicious of her, and then, like, Luffy's like, yay! And Zoro's like, no! Like,
you know what it is? They also have a very, like, Luffy is Lupin, Zoro is Jigen, and Nami is Fujiko.
Yeah, so I do, except for, you know, like, Luffy isn't interested in romance or anything, so, like, but yeah, I do feel like...
Lupin isn't interested in romance, Kate, you know what he thinks.
I should... You know what I meant. But yeah, I just feel like, I feel like there's a lot more tension between them, I guess, in the earlier arcs, mm-hmm. because she's, like, so untrustworthy, and, like, Zoro is suspicious of her, so I think there's just, like, a lot more interaction between them, and that's maybe where it's coming from, and where I even got it from. But then, like, as the story goes on, there's just, like, more characters, and, like, everybody doesn't interact in the same way as, like, they once did. But, you know, those early, it's been so long since I've, like, read early One Piece, so. Oh, but I would definitely have 100% of an opinion about this, so.
I mean, if you watch it, it's not bad. I feel like, once again, it has the most important thing, that they understand the themes, they understand the characters.
Will you watch season two?
I don't know. I'm like, if people were, like, very curious about my opinion, I'd watch season two. Like, there's nothing about what I saw made me not want to watch season two. But I don't feel like I'm, like, one of these fans who was like, oh, man, if this gets canceled, I'm going to be so upset. This is the first really good adaptation of an anime. You know, I feel it's definitely competent. It definitely, like, knows how to do this well. So, or at least knows how to do it not to betray the source material or make go, like... Did you actually read One Piece, or, like, did you understand what you read? Because I feel like, once again, the people who made live-action Cowboy Bebop actually watched Cowboy Bebop. It's just very clear they did not understand what they watched.
I have to say, your review of this has made me pretty curious, not just because of Nami and Zoro, but, like, Muppets and, like, I don't know, like, I'm now like, the practical effects side, like, it makes me kind of interested, like,
I mean, there is some corniness, and, like, some of the fight scenes that aren't with Sanji and Zoro are a little weirdly slow, just because they have to, like, you know, some of it's just CG, and some of it's, like, you know, these guys are more actors than trained fighters, obviously. Like Zoro, I forget the name of his actor, but he's, you know, super well trained. You can tell when it's just a Zoro fight that, like, oh, this guy actually knows how to do this shit. And, like, and at least the actor who plays Sanji has, like, had enough training that he can, you know, do things decently well. But I don't know. I don't think you'll have a bad.
I might watch some.
I am shocked it came out as well as say that.
I think that's, at least, that would be my opinion. Like, if I watched it and liked it, I would be shocked.
I will mention one other thing that people might take objection to is the fishmen seem very black coast, which could make some of their stuff a little more problematic than it was in the original manga, because they're just, I don't feel like they're really coded.
That's interesting.
But, you know, I guess I'm curious what you think of all of that, if you do.
I think it's going to happen. Besides, like, there's not going to be a lot of shows, right? Because there's still strike going on. So I'm sure that, like, I'll have time, maybe. All right. So I want to end this episode of the podcast by talking about the Megumi Hayashibara memoir that came out in English. Is actually released globally, you know, simultaneously, I guess, in English and Japanese, which is called The Characters Taught Me Everything. And it's not a autobiography, it's really a memoir where, you know, she's really talking about, like, reflecting on her career as a voice actress, and it's segmented into different decades and then significant characters or moments, because she doesn't go through every single role that she's done, but, like, major characters or characters that she had, like, you know, a story about or thoughts about the process, or, you know, just you know, kind of however she wanted to talk about those characters. And so it goes up through the 2010s. So, like, you know, like, it even has Rakugo in there. So it's very recent. It mentions COVID in it. So, you know, like, she really wrote it during that period of time. And it's really good. She doesn't approach each character in the same way. So it's just, you know, like, sometimes one story, she'll name drop a whole bunch of people because they were, like, significant to some part of her process in that particular role. But then other series where, you know, like, all these other big, you know, people were in it, they aren't mentioned because it doesn't factor into, like, kind of what track she's taking with talking about the characters. So it has, like, a varied approach to it. And, like, sometimes there's life advice. And, like, a lot of it is through, like, what she learned from playing that role. And then, like, how she took it into herself. And then, like, how it maybe changed her point of view about life. Or how she approached things. Or, like, how she thought about stuff. And then, like, how she sort of turned that around. And then, you know, either brought it into another character. Or is sort of, like, advising the reader about, like, how she could approach life in the same way as a character, as one of the characters. So it's very interesting. And you get a lot of just, like, very interesting tidbits. I'm going to call out a few that I thought were interesting or particularly relevant to me, but, like, there's just so much in the book. So, of course, a major character in here is Rei from Eva, and I think she does have the longest section, where Megumi is sort of talking about one aspect of Rei, which is that she got from Anno, or, like, when he was telling kind of her about this character, was that he described Rei as, it's not that she doesn't have emotions, she's just not familiar with emotions. And, like, taking that distinction and, like, really trying to hone, like, what that means. So I thought that was, like, just an interesting insight into that character. And the other fun thing in her talking about the whole process on Eva is she initially thought she would get the role of Misato or Asuka. And so when she was, like, cast as Rei, she was like, there must be a mistake. Like, I'm sure for, you know, older listeners that are our age, we all know this. But, like, for younger listeners, the character of Rei, like, when she came on the scene, there wasn't another character like Rei. Like, so it wasn't a standard. It wasn't a formula. You know, like, it was like, oh, who is this? And, like, how do you play this character? And, like, this is so new. So there's a lot in Megumi's sort of recollections about her that are really interesting. And then how that character became an archetype.
I think it's interesting to point out the new people who have maybe not been in the scene long, or even maybe somebody who didn't realize that, who has been in the scene long, that, like, all those characters that you see today are all a Rei Aranami clones. They're all back to her.
So, like, that whole section is just, like, yeah, totally fascinating, really interesting insights in that one. Lina Inverse from Slayers, obviously, like, super important to me. And, like, as I was reading this section, after I finished reading it, like, I had to go watch some Slayers just because, like, I just needed some, like, Lina voice and, like, just her whole bravado, like, in my life after reading about it. And so, of course, Lina is, like, this really, really bold character who, like, is really confident. She says what she's gonna do, and she goes and does it. She's, like, very independent. Megumi also said that Megumi sings on a lot of Slayer's soundtrack. And, of course, she sang in a lot of 90s anime very famously. But she said that, like, playing Lina, like, allowed her to, like, write music, because she doesn't write any of, like, I don't think for the first two seasons, but, like, later seasons of Slayers, like, some of the songs are, like, she wrote the songs, and then, like, she becomes, like, a writer of music. Like, she kind of attributes it to, like, her time as Lina. Also, so I think it's really interesting. I was thinking about how, after reading this and, you know, watching Slayers, some Slayers and stuff, that Lena's almost, like, the opposite of Rei. in the sense that Lena is an incredibly popular character. She's like a beloved character, but for some reason, I can't really think of a lot of characters that are like Lena, and I don't know why that is, but she is like, she's the best. I want to be Lena when I grow up. She is my role model. But I just thought it was so weird that, like, she is beloved and ever forever popular, but I don't feel like there's, like, a bunch of characters that you could say are like her at all. There's a really great section about Faye from Cowboy Bebop and about, like, femininity and, like, how, like, Faye, in contrast to Julia, there's, like, some really great stuff there. There's a fun section about Rebecca from One Piece and, like, Megumi meeting Oda for the first time. And, like, it wasn't because she was going to be in One Piece. They were, like, both on vacation. And then they, like, met at a luau or something. And then she was with another voice actress. And that's how, like, she ended up, like, meeting him. And they were like, oh, he's going to be there. Like, let's go and, like, hang out. And then she does. And she was sort of talking about how she couldn't believe, like, this guy was, you know, responsible for One Piece, but then he ate, like, a giant plate of meat, and just, like, she was like, oh, yes, this must be the man who created Luffy. So there's, like, you know, so there's, like, funny stories like that, and then there's, like, more thoughtful stuff about, like, you know, how did she, like, approach this character. And, like, and then the last one I wanted to call out was when she's played Hakumen from Ushio and Tora, who is, like, the big villain character. And when she plays that character, it's, like, again, a huge departure from, like, the kind of characters she usually plays. So her talking about sort of her approach to that was very interesting. And she said that during recording sessions, she would wear all white, just like Hakumen, and then not sit with the other voice actors. So, like, she was, like tried to be apart from them as the villain. And also because the way Hakumen sort of, like, views the world. Like, if you've seen Ushio and Tora, like, you know, Hakumen, like, feeds on, like, the hatred of the world. So, like, that was very interesting. And then she also talked about how they recorded the voice for it. So she actually, for her lines, they would record her twice. So she would say the line, she would do the line regularly, and then she would also do the line in, like, a whispery thing. And then they overlaid them to create the voice of Hakumen in the series. So, like, she talks a little bit technical there, and, like, yeah, so, and there's just all kinds of, like, tidbits like that in the memoir. And so it was really great. Like, I read the whole thing, even for characters that I wasn't, like, familiar with, you know. And she also talks about, like, her first roles and, like, struggling with that, and, like, mentoring that she got from other voice actors, and, like, friendships that she made. And, like I said, there's, like, name dropping of, like, big huge voice actors. And then there's footnotes for a lot of, like, when she name drops somebody, or, like, even for, there's, like, really great notes throughout the book explaining certain things that she says that maybe she doesn't, you know, go into, like, because she's just, you know, kind of talking conversationally. But there's good notes in it. And yeah, it's just, like, a really nicely put together book, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I really want Megumi to come to Otakon.
So, were there any characters you're surprised she didn't mention, or did mention more than you thought? Like, wow, she really went on a long time about that. Like, obviously, like, Rei or, like, Faye, you, like, kind of expect. But, like, or, like, man, she didn't bring up, she was this character at all, or had nothing to say about that?
There wasn't anybody that she didn't bring up that I was, you know, like, oh, I can't believe she didn't talk about this person. But there were, like, sometimes she would be so insightful about characters that I vaguely know or, like, didn't think a lot about. Like, when she has, like, a whole section about, like, Blue Seed. And, like, you know, it gets, like, a little bit, like, about, like, the world and, like, philosophy. And, like, I mean, so you're just like, whoa, you know, like, so not that that series isn't about those things, but, like, just the way she sort of intook them. And then, like, or you know, for her, I think, what does she remember about being, you know, like, she's had this long career at this point, so it's like her going back and thinking about, like, oh, what do I remember about this particular anime or story, or, you know, so.
Clearly you were thrilled about the section that she went on about being Lime and Saber marionette, right?
Oh, yes. So, like, yeah, that doesn't get, I mean, it's in there, not like, because, but it's not like a very long section.
Well, it's just, I know that you infamously do not like, yeah, I mean, Saber marionette.
I mean, does anyone really?
you got several seasons, this one fucker out there at least.
I don't know about that. But the thing is like, even for a series that I didn't like, right, she would have something really thoughtful to say about. Like, she did have something. I don't remember what it is now, but, like, she had something really thoughtful.
Marionette. That's fine.
She did.
Oh,
she
no, had it something... is. It's the fact that you don't remember is fine, Kate, because it's Saber Marionette.
Yeah, but, like, she did have something, like, really thoughtful, you know, that, like, about it. And so it's, like, it was just really interesting to see how she approached characters. And, like, even later in her career, there were characters where, like, you know, she was saying, you know, that she was struggling with, that she just wasn't getting it right, even late in her career. And so, like, how she had to, like, rethink, like, all right, I have to reset and think about it a different way. Or, like, she talks a lot about the process of voice acting in Japan, where, like, everybody's in the same room until recently, you know. And one of the things she talked about was one character, I can't remember right now off the top of my head, like, what character it was, but it was basically what she realized was that she was playing that character, but she wasn't playing that character as if she was really listening to the other people talking to her, like, or talking in the scene. Like, she was just so focused on, like, my lines, you know, that, like, she wasn't then, like, in concert, I guess. And so, like, it also just made me think about some of the struggles that we see in American voice acting, because sometimes people don't even get to know, like, who else is on the, you know, like, they record by themselves, or they don't even know, like, who they're recording for, or, like, what, it, you know, like, that there's a lot of times there's so much, like, secrecy, or, like, or the quickness in which it has to be done, that, like, that we don't really have the same process. And, like, it was just interesting to hear her talk about how it changed the way she approached things. And, you know, there's just, like, lots of good stuff in there.
I'm curious, just because it's, like, such a long role. Did she talk, remember anything about her being Musashi, a.k.a. Jessie from Pokemon?
Yeah, she did talk about that a lot. She had a big section about that, because she was talking about how the family vibe with, like, the Team Rocket, how that really, like, is something that, you know, is so beloved, and, like, how she felt like the dynamic, she helped change the dynamic a little bit, because she didn't want Jessie to just be, like, mean and forcing everybody to do things all the time. So there's, like, a shift, I guess. I mean, you know, like, I only remember some of the series, yeah. But, like, she kind of talks about sort of that familial relationship in the story a bunch, and, like, how meaningful, you know, that was. So that one, which is a really long role, she talks a lot about I from Conan.
I was
Conan.
About to say, I thought it was odd that you didn't mention I.
Well, I couldn't mention everything, you know, like, I can't believe how long she has played that character. And again, kind of a character whose relationship with Conan evolves quite a bit over the course of the story. And so she talks about that, and about, like, you know, like, how she's changed, like, over time since the series has, like, run for so long. So, like, that was all really, it's just, like, yeah, she was just so, like, sometimes it was a, like, there were, like, sometimes there's, like, cheesy, I feel like, moments in the book of, like, almost, like, a little bit of, like, a self-help vibe, like, occasionally, or, like, advice, you know, to the reader sort of vibe, which, like, didn't always really land with me, but, like, when she was just talking about her own insights, it was always really great.
I was also just curious, like, that you mentioned it, her, like, I'm very curious about her, like, her insights into her rock character, because that was, once again, very different from form, and I'm sure she had some interesting insights on.
I can't believe you haven't asked about Ranma.
Oh, yeah, I looked over a thing, and I was thinking, did she say anything about being female? When I looked over the list, I thought about asking that, and then I forgot about it because that is a good question. Thank you, Kate.
The thing that I remember from her talking about that was the sort of the challenge that she had in there was she's supposed to be, you know, she's the first, I think initially they weren't sure if they were gonna actually switch the voice. So I think that was, I forget when they decided to make that decision, like that they were actually going to have two voices as opposed to just like, you know, one person playing Ranma. And then the other part that's interesting is the challenge was I'm playing the female voice, but it's a guy being a you know, like, so yeah. The way he, Ranma talks, I shouldn't say he, but like the way Ranma talks is still male, even though it's his female version. So like, that was like the challenge there was like, you know, okay, well, you know, I still have to be a certain way. So like Ranma would still approach it in a certain way, but like I just have a different voice. So like that was interesting. I don't know if I explained that well.
Yeah, but... yeah, I get what you're saying. That like basically I'm using my voice normally, but I'm playing a male character.
Right, who's very voice. Male, you know, yeah. Like who's... still trying to be male, even though like it's not as if Ranma is trying to be really feminine, right, when he changes into his female form. So like, yeah, so that was interesting.
Sounds like a very interesting, cool book.
It's really great. I highly recommend it to everybody. Like I said, it had an English simultaneous English Japanese release, so it's put out by Yen Press, so it's pretty easy to find. And there's also a digital version. So, all right, that wraps up another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. October will be new anime season, so get ready, buckle up for that. There's like about 50,000 new shows.
Sounds fun, I'm sure. If nothing else, we'll hopefully find some good, really good ones with that many new shows.
And there's a lot of returning stuff, so it should be good all around. So we will see you next month.
Present day. Present time.